Today's Taisho will be on Case 67 in the Book of Serenity. The Flower Ornament Sutra's Wisdom. Introduction. One atom contains myriad forms. One thought includes a billion worlds. What about a powerful person who wears the sky on his head and stands on the ground? A spiritually sharp person who knows the tail when the head is spoken of. Doesn't that person turn his back on his own spirit and bury the family treasure? Case. The flower ornament scripture says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, but because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. Verse. Sky covers, earth bears, making a mass, making a clump. Pervading the universe without bound, breaking down subatomic particles with no inside. Getting to the end of the mysterious subtlety. Who distinguishes turning towards from turning away? Buddhas and patriarchs come to pay the debt for what they said. Ask old teacher Wang of Nanchen. Each person just eats one stalk of vegetable. I want to thank everybody for coming here today to practice this beautiful path of Chan, of Zen. Some of you are here, I believe, for the first time. At any rate, some of you are here at the Taisho for the first time. And perhaps I should explain a few things about Taisho. First of all, this is not like a lecture in school. If you were thinking that you might make some notes, please don't do that. Please put your notebook away and just listen to the talk. A few years ago, there was a person who was coming for a little while who actually used to take notes, and it would make me very nervous, as a matter of fact. Because that's not really the purpose of the Taisho. It's not like a college lecture. You know. We're all very well trained. We go through a high school, and we take notes in high school. And then we come to college, and we take notes in college, or we buy notes from Scarlet Notes. If we didn't catch the class because we were sleeping. And, you know, on the basis of the notes, you're tested, right? So the teacher will construct a test, and you'll take the test, and your performance will be assessed. And on a test, there's such a thing as a right answer or a wrong answer, or a good answer or a bad answer. And so that's a fundamental difference from the Taisho, because the interesting thing about a Taisho is that it doesn't really matter whether you understand it or not. That's very important. See, it doesn't really matter whether you understand it or not. It doesn't really matter whether I'm clear or not, which is fortunate, you know, a lot of the time. Because a lot of the time I'm not. But it doesn't matter, see. If you come to practice and you hear the Taisho and you understand it, excellent. You're in awakened mind. Yeah? And if you come to practice and you're sitting on the cushion and you're listening to this Teisho, and you think, what the heck is he talking about? So I don't understand. Also in awakened mind. So that's the beauty of the Teisho. Whether you understand it or not, you're there. Whether you understand it. And this is quite distinctive from any other form of discourse that I know of. Let me just read the case one more time. These cases are sayings of or stories, about great Zen teachers during the Tang and Song dynasty. And they often involve a moment when a student had an awakening experience, but not always. In this case, Zhen Wang came in front of his assembly of practitioners, of monks and nuns, and he said, "The Flower Ornament Sutra says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere, possess fully the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, but because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it." We tend to think in terms of gain and loss, right and wrong, understanding and not understanding, passing the test and failing the test. But Chan, Zen, is about a kind of reality which is present whether you are right or wrong, whether you are going to get an A on the test or an F on the test. That's, to me, quite interesting and quite important. You know, some of you came here this morning and you may have sat on the cushion. I don't know how it went for you today, but last week I got back from Southern Virginia, where I have been moving my mother into an assisted living arrangement. And my sister and I had worked very hard to encourage my mother to enter this facility. And then we all worked very hard to move her furniture, some of her furniture into the facility, and so on. And my wife did a wonderful job in really decorating my mother's new room. And then I came back, and that evening I had to participate in a funeral ceremony for a member of the Sri Lankan community. And I had driven for 9 hours, as a matter of fact, and I was a little bit tired. But he asked me to come, so I put on, it was a formal situation, so I put on my robes and I went. And I forgot my meditation cushion. And so he gave me some pillows from his sofa to sit on. And I was tired, and I thought there was no mat. I didn't have a mat. I sat on the wooden floor, and I put these pillows under my bottom. And I just thought, oh boy, let's see what happens. I'm tired, you know, this is going to be very uncomfortable. And at any rate, a monk from the Sri Lankan community spoke first. And he spoke for a long time. And by the way, he spoke for a long time. He was sitting in a chair, you know, a comfortable chair. So there was no constraint on his time. And I was on the floor, sitting in my usual position. And he went on and on and on and on, and like for more than an hour. And then there was a break, and then I was supposed to say something. So the point is, we started at 7, and I didn't really get to speak until about 9:15. And then we weren't really done until 10:15. But the amazing thing was, you know, I just sat down and got up at 10:15 and I felt great. My legs didn't hurt. I didn't take any breaks. It was just like magic, right? You know, sometimes that just happens, right? Just happens like that. I just thought, gee, maybe I ought to sit on these kinds of pillows from now on. You know, because these sofa pillows, you know, maybe these Zafus are no good. You know, we need to it was just the way it goes, right? I had a wonderful sit. You know, but even after 30 years of doing this, sometimes I sit down on the cushion, you know, and can't quite get it right. You know, it's like one leg is a little, for some reason, is a little off center, and it goes to sleep. Yeah, that happens to me too. Goes to sleep. Or you know, maybe my hip joint hurts. You know, and you go into samadhi and you try to deal with this, and you know, it's just sort of like a toothache, right? And that happens to me too. You know, and I'm sorry to disillusion you, but maybe after 40 years that doesn't happen, but after 30 years it still happens. You know? And to tell you the truth, that actually happened to me this morning. Partly, maybe it was because I actually went jogging yesterday afternoon, and I went for a long jog, and maybe my muscles are tired. But about halfway through this morning's sit, after the first hour and a half, my legs were really talking to me, you know. So I had to go really deep into samadhi. I really had to go deep into samadhi. And after about, and just like everybody else, you know, when my legs hurt, I sit there and I think, oh, damn it, I really hate this, you know. I've been doing this for 30 years, my legs still hurt, you know. So you sit there and say, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. And then, you know, all of a sudden, I literally felt like a big smile open up inside myself. It was, I swear to you, it was just like my whole body was smiling. And I felt so happy. See, I felt so happy. Even though, you know, and you're waiting for me to say, and all the pain went away in my legs, but it didn't, you know. Still there. But I was so happy after that. And it was just, it was unmistakable feeling of, like, joy. And the truth is, you know, when I was last Saturday night at the funeral ceremony, you know, I was in Buddha mind, deeply in Buddha mind. But the truth is, this morning, I was deeply in Buddha mind. So the interesting thing is that, you know, whatever we call Buddha mind is there, whether we're in pain or not in pain, you know, whether we're distracted or not distracted. This is something special. You know, actually, awakened mind is not a state. It's not a state. Like, there's different states of mind. You can be distracted or you can be focused. You can be angry or you can be kindly. You can be happy or you can be sad. Those are states. But when we talk about awakened mind or Buddha mind, we're talking about something that is present in every state. It's like the background behind, it's like every state is like a little show on a stage. But if you take the curtains back, you see the Buddha mind is behind it. It's always there. It's always there. This is very interesting. And my feeling is that not only is this true, but that people are constantly trying to get to Buddha mind, even though they may never have heard of Chan or Zen or Buddhism. I have this feeling that all of us are all the time trying to return to this ground or this background. It's like the earth under our feet, no matter where we stand, right? It's like the earth under, it can't be taken away from us. It's always present. It's as common as dirt. And we're trying to get back to it all the time. I really believe this. I was reading this article. Some of you may know that I like to backpack. I've been a backpacker for more than 30 years. I love backpacking, and I still subscribe to Outside Magazine. And I was one of the when it came out. I think I was one of the first subscribers, and I have literally never stopped getting Outside Magazine. So I was reading this latest Outside Magazine, and there's a story about a woman named Stephanie Davis. I don't know if you've ever heard of her, but in the rock climbing world, she's a free climber. She's the kind, you know these people who climb up mountains with their bare hands, and they don't, you know, they just put a little chalk dust on their fingers and then they go up the side of a mountain? Well, she's one of these people. And she's really quite highly regarded in free climbing circles as one of the very best in the world. And the story about her life was so interesting because she had a typical upbringing, typical sort of middle class upbringing. And she was very interested in piano and was an English major and was studying really with the goal of becoming a lawyer. And her parents very much wanted her to become a lawyer. And in the spring, during her freshman year, a friend of hers invited her to go out rock climbing, which she had never done. And she said that the day she did that, her life was never the same. This happens to people, right? You know, you do something and you just realize this is my path, right? Just this is my path. So she stopped playing piano. She was attending the University of Maryland. And she shifted over to Colorado State because she could practice in the mountains there. And she graduated from Colorado State. And then her parents said, okay, well, now it's time for law school. And what she did was just totally crazy, right? She decided she was going to live in her car, wait on tables, and practice free climbing. You can imagine, her parents were horrified. She actually built a bed in the back of her car, right? And she lived in her car for 9 years, okay? And she got up every day, and she climbed up the sides of these mountains, and she supported herself by working as a waitress. There's some other details about her that I thought were interesting. Through it all, Davis remained her usual geeky, systematic self. Though she never made more than $6,000 a year, she managed to open an IRA. We could all do that if we lived in our car. She read constantly, everything from Gabriel Garcia Marquez to Kirstie Alley's autobiography, to French short stories she translated herself. She said, I felt scared all the time. My parents did not like my choices and thought I was doing stupid things with my life, and they told me so. I didn't feel like anyone cared if I did a climb I was proud of. She was just doing it for herself. Eventually, she ran into this guy who, strangely enough, was also living in his car and climbing mountains, you know? Dean Potter. And now they live in a trailer. That's the truth. She has a contract, right? She has a contract from Patagonia. It doesn't pay much. They live in a trailer, and they spend 6 months a year climbing mountains, right? Going up the side of mountains without any ropes, you know. Now, I just have to tell you, I love people like that, you know? I just think that is fantastic, you know? This is somebody who found her path in life, right? And, you know, it takes a certain kind of person to have that degree of open-heartedness, right? I mean, most people hedge their bets a little bit, right? You know, most people say, well, and actually, I myself, I'm not sure about living in a car, you know what I mean? That might be going too far, but, you know, she loved what she did, right? And she lived in a car, and she climbed 12 hours a day and waited on tables. And there's something, I think, really admirable about a person who's able to be so open-hearted about her path in life, right? And I just have to admire that, and I have to say, you know, what is she looking for? You know, what is she trying to do? Because she certainly wasn't, she's rather well known, but she still doesn't make any money off of what she's doing. And you know, in a previous issue of Outside Magazine, they had an obituary for another famous free climber. It's like, sooner or later I'm going to open Outside Magazine and it's going to be the obituary for Steph Davis, you know. But there's something about going up the side of a mountain that for her is, I think it's a lot like what I experience on the cushion. I really believe that. You know, I think that when she goes up the side of a mountain, she gets outside of herself and she enters into what we Zen people call big mind. You know, big mind. A blue sky mind. Ao-zo. Ao Zo, Lan Tian, Lan Tian, like the mind, like the sky, right? And it's for her, it's obviously worth anything. In the article, they talk about the fact that she had climbed, when this reporter went to find her, she'd been climbing all day, she only got halfway up a face, and he said she had to spend the night on a ledge that was 2 feet, a granite ledge, that was like 2.5 feet wide. She's gonna sleep up there, right? All night, granite, right? And get up in the morning and finish her climb. So I just think that's wonderful. I can't help it. I just think that, you know, that's kind of like what we do. We don't climb up the side of mountains, but we sit for 8 or 9 hours a day. People think we're crazy too, right? So I think that she's driven by something like the same desire that we're driven by. You know, this passion for getting outside of the self and getting connected to a bigger life. And I think this is distinctly human. You know, I think all underneath all of our confusion and our fears and our anger, there's this part of ourselves that's trying to wake up like a little chick trying to peck its way out of an eggshell, out of its egg, you know. You're in the egg and you're pecking and pecking and you're trying to get out, you know. And I think all of us, all human beings are like this. I came across this other story too that was just amazing. It's a guy named Carl Cook. And this was an article in the LA Times. It says, Carl Cook is not a typical Clipper season ticket holder. For one thing, he's homeless. This guy doesn't even have a bed in his car. For another, he owns no car, nor is he licensed to drive. But Cook, 46, nevertheless is unflagging in his support of the Clippers, who return to Staples Center tonight for Game 3 of their Western Conference semifinals against the Phoenix Suns. This guy literally lives to go to the games of his team. Yeah, he lives in the stadium, right? And he does odd jobs, and he rides his bike around town, and he goes, his annual income is less than $10,000. He spent $3,500 on tickets for this season. Okay? And by the way, the team almost never wins. That's interesting, isn't it? Somebody said he just eats, sleeps, and lives the Clippers. said the middle of his three sisters, Jody Cook of Oceanside. Every time he comes to visit, he's always in a t-shirt or a sweatshirt, something that has clippers on it. Whenever I talk to him during the season or out, he talks about the clippers. I've never seen anything like him, especially to hang in there with that terrible team. Sister said, it's odd, but it's his life. Said Cook, they bring me happiness. Yeah? I just think that's wonderful. Yeah? I think that's wonderful to have that kind of a passion. And the interesting thing is the team hardly ever wins. It doesn't matter. That's not what he's after. It's not win or lose. It's not what he's after. Right? It's not what he's after. There's something deeper that he gets from this. Right? This is, I just think it's maybe these people are a little over the top. These are sort of like obsessive personalities, maybe a little bit. But I admire, it's kind of frightening, right, when you experience people like that, because they're so open-hearted about what they love that they don't do what we usually do and what I myself have often done in my life, you know, which is sort of tally up the risks, the pluses and the minuses, the risks and the rewards. These are people who are remarkably open-hearted. And I think that there's something saintly, if you want to put it that way, about both of these people. I think Steph Davis is like saint of free climbing. And I think Mr. Cook is a saint of fandom, you know, of a Clippers fandom. And I don't mean it, I'm half kidding. But on a deeper level, there's something they get into contact with which is very, very important. And I think there are people who live their whole lives sort of squelching this impulse. But I think it's an impulse that we all feel. It drives so much of human behavior. You know, this desire to get outside of the self, get beyond this, get connected to something beyond ourselves, larger than ourselves. You know. There's a professor here at Rutgers, and he's written a book called, his name is Bruce Wilshire. And I don't know him personally. I don't know Professor Wilshire personally. But he's written a rather interesting book, I thought, called Wild Hunger. And Wilshire is fascinated by the problems our society has with drug addiction and alcoholism. And indeed, they're serious problems. Huge numbers of Americans are alcoholics. Have drinking problems, and very large numbers of Americans have problems with alcohol. And the book is very thoughtful exploration of what people do when they drink or when they take drugs, and their behavior has something in common with Stephanie Davis's behavior or Mr. Cook's behavior. There's a kind of obsessive character to it. But behind that obsessive character, and there's something very destructive about what they do too, is this powerful hunger. He says wild hunger, to get beyond the self and into something bigger. And I think that this is like a basic human motivation. Part of our development as human beings is becoming a self. You know, so it is important to go through the usual adolescent rituals, I think, of becoming a person. You know, you learn how to be a certain kind of human being. And a lot of the agony of adolescence is trying to convince yourself that you can really be a human being, right? Because you don't feel like one. Most people, when they're teenagers, at least judging from my own experience, I think a lot of people feel like hopelessly out of touch with other people. Socially unacceptable, sort of monstrous and awkward, and so we work very hard to, you know, get the right kind of jeans and get the right kind of haircut and say the right things, we're hoping to be socially acceptable, right? And we pick up a role model and we begin to emulate the role model. Now, I think all of this is really essential to becoming a human being. This acquiring a self. But then I think there's this other aspect of human life, which is getting beyond the self. Because at a certain point, I think it's quite obvious that being a self is rather unsatisfying, right? It's necessary, but at some point, it's rather, you've sort of done that, right? At some point, you're just all dressed up in your life and you have nowhere to go. And that's what it means to be a self, right? You work so hard to be presentable, and then you're presentable, and then you think, now what? Right? And it's sort of slightly boring. When you get to be a certain age, I think you begin to have this wild hunger, this desire for connection. And many things in our society appeal to this desire, not always in a good way. So I even think consumerism is has a kind of quality of sort of an ecstatic quality, really. I think that consumerism promises this kind of connection with something bigger. You know, I really do know people who are like shopaholics. Many years ago, my wife and I were traveling with my brother-in-law and his wife, Janet. And we went to Mexico, and then we were coming back from Mexico to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where my brother-in-law and my wife's family are from. And we left a town in northern Mexico, and we drove to Albuquerque. And this is like a tourist pilgrimage. People, mainly Americans, go down to this town in Chihuahua, and they go down there and they stay and they buy all kinds of Mexican products, tourist products, and then they drive back up to New Mexico with their goodies. And we drove down to Chihuahua, which is actually a rather nice town. Actually, I kind of liked it. While we were there, my sister-in-law, Janet, literally the car was like loaded with stuff, you know? And then as we drove back to Albuquerque, we could never get more than like, I don't know, it just seemed like every half hour we had to stop at some little store and buy some more stuff. So it was like literally, I was wondering, you know, at some point the car's going to just break down under the weight of all this junk. And you know, this is like, you know, obviously these are not things, by the way, I love my sister-in-law, and I know she'll never listen to this talk. And her name really isn't Janet, it's Betsy. That's it, Betsy. Her name really is Janet. But I do know she'll never listen to this, and if she does listen to it, she knows I love her anyway. And we've already had this discussion. But I think that there is such a thing as a shopaholic. I think there is such a thing as a person who obsessively keeps trying to acquire new things and tries to, you know, you're looking for some kind of an experience when you do this, right? You think, if I get this Mexican blanket, my whole life is going to be brighter. And I'm going to have a bright mind for hours. And you get the blanket, you put it on the floor. Indeed, for a while, you do have a bright mind, right? You feel very nice, very alive. After a while, it's just a blanket, you know? Years ago, the Dalai Lama came to the University of Washington, where I was going to school, and he gave a talk. And he said something that really stuck in my mind. He said, you do some things, and the more you do them, the more alive you feel. And you do some things, and the more you do them, the more, he didn't really say dead, but the less aware you feel. And he said that driving, in his experience, had been something that initially was fascinating, right? I'm sure we can all remember, you know, when I was 16, I wanted that driving license so badly. And I went through driver's education school in the summer with my high school coach, who used to chew tobacco and spit it out the window. But it was, and he was a nice guy, but I went through the whole summer with him, with Coach Mitchell, you know. And I got my driver's license. And after about 3 months, driving was the least interesting thing I could do, in my opinion. I mean, different people have different doors into reality, but for me, driving just isn't one of them. You know, you do some things, and it differs from person to person. You do some things, and it just after a while just fades away. But there's some things you do that constantly open new doors for you. It's just you keep feeling that life is opening up. And I think for somebody like Stephanie Davis, it's climbing a mountain. She's climbed, you know, how many hundreds of mountain faces? But it doesn't matter, because that's her path. That's her Tao, right? And whether the Clippers ever win a game or not is not going to matter to Mr. Cook. And so I think our culture offers us sometimes false avenues or false promises. It says, oh, you'll achieve a bigger life if you buy this, you know, if you do this. So I think our culture is somewhat seductive. I think many people buy a bigger house and then it's just a house and they're not any happier. Or they buy a new car and it's just a car. But I think everybody's sort of, in a way, searching for that sense of connection. And I even think that desire for connection can take sinister or destructive forms. You know, a lot of times people could become terribly attached to different values or identity, like collective identity. I'm always a little nervous about people who get too excited about being an American, you know. Now, let me just say I'm proud to be an American, right? I'm proud, I am an American, and I'm grateful for being an American. But I think if you get too obsessed with being an American, right, I'm uneasy with that, you know, because I would like to be, first of all, a human being, right, who happens to live in America. But there's a kind of ecstasy, sort of like collective ecstasy, right, of being an American, right, or it could be anything, being in British, being French, being Pakistani, you know, whatever. It can be religious. You know, you can have a kind of collective ecstasy. You know, we're all Buddhists here. You know, Buddhists. We're all Buddhists. You know? And it promises, like, and that's going to be the door, right? We're all Buddhists here. Now, we don't want any non-Buddhists. We just want Buddhists. You know, we're all the same, and there's a kind of collective ecstasy, right? And I personally think that's very dangerous. I think that's like it promises a kind of contact with the universe, but I think it's a little bit like consumerism. It's kind of a dangerous and seductive, in my opinion, seductive. You know? So I think that where I'm going with this is I think all humans have a deep desire for this connection to the universe, right? Connection to the universe. I love this phrase. Allen Ginsberg has a phrase, the starry dynamo, right? Like, that's great. The star, you want to hook up to the starry dynamo. You know, just, there's a deep, when you sit on the cushion and you feel that energy going through you, that's the starry dynamo. That's what he meant. And he did, by the way, Ginsberg did a lot of meditation. And I think all of us have this deep hunger, this deep desire for contact with something bigger than ourselves. And I think, you know, sometimes it's dangerous because it can take these destructive forms. Drug use. You know, people have kind of ecstatic drug use. Ecstatic out. You know, a number of people in my family have been alcoholics, and I myself don't drink at all, and I haven't had anything. I've never had a drinking problem, but I stopped drinking many years ago because I thought it interfered with my clarity when I did meditation, really and truly. But I think people in my family who developed drinking problems, and there were many of them, were looking to get outside of themselves and get hooked to the starry dynamo, linked up to the starry dynamo. And they just got caught in a false path, you know. So, I mean, this is one way to look at everything. I mean, my feeling is that, you know, if you look at the human race and you open the newspaper and you read Mr. That British scientist, what was his name? Martin Rees, about 2 months ago, issued a statement saying that the chances of our civilization surviving were about 50-50. He's a very famous cosmologist, and I've read some of his books, they're interesting. And he is president of the British Academy of Sciences, and they issued this statement and said, you know, we're courting disaster. You look at war and all this violence and all of this mess. And there's a way of looking at that and just saying, you know, how did we go so wrong? But I think it's very complicated because in so many ways we're trying to go so right. You know, we're looking for something that's really positive, but we walk up these blind alleys and we make these terrible mistakes, and they turn us into monsters sometimes, really and truly. We do things that are truly like monstrous. But behind some of these terrible actions is this longing, which I think we all share. You know, we all share it. And so I think that makes the human situation rather complicated. You know, even people like, you know, Stalin were trying to protect something he thought of as like this sacred thing. You know, in the meantime, he killed like 20 million people. But I honestly believe this. Maybe I'm just naive, but I think all humans have this desire to connect. So one way to look at the whole human situation is to say it's a wreck, it's irredeemable, etc. But another way to look at it is to say, you know, on the ground floor, all human beings want this connection. And when they get it, they turn into really good people. You know, if you enter samadhi, sooner or later you're going to get hooked up to the starry dynamo. And in that state, you know, your heart melts, you feel full of love, you see your own failings, you get up, you know, people go to Sesshin and they come back, and at the end of Sesshin they come in to see me and they say, you know, I'm going to call my brother and tell him I love him. You know, that's like success, right? That's a successful Sesshin. I think all humans have that in there somewhere. And one of the beautiful things about our path is that I think it's so reliable as a way of getting there. You know, I have the highest admiration for Stephanie Davis, but you know, unlike Stephanie Davis, I'm on a nice soft cushion, you know, can't fall, you know. I could probably use a little more exercise. She gets a lot more exercise than I do. But this is pretty safe, right? You know, if you do meditation for 8 hours a day, your knees are going to be a little sore. That's about it, right? We've never had an accident. Nobody's ever had to be rushed to the hospital. You know? Nobody's ever died from the pain in their legs, you know, really. Might feel that way sometime, but actually no. So this is like very safe, right? And very reliable. Because the truth is, you know, the Clippers, our sports team, and probably a lot of people on the Clippers take steroids, and you know, they get exploited by the sports franchise. They play hard for 10 years, and then they injure their knee and they get dumped. When I was a kid, in our neighborhood, there was a very nice man down the street named Rod Breedlove. And Rod Breedlove had been a sports idol. And then he had injured himself, and after that he worked in town as a bartender. And he had no savings. He was a wonderful man. But he had a very humble life in spite of his formerly high status in the sports world. And really he had been exploited by his team. You know, another beautiful thing about our path is that, you know, very reliable, very safe, And I think if you stay on this road, it will have a happy ending for you. There's something special about our path, and that is it's so direct. You know, you can climb up a mountain to get there. You can ride your bike around and go to sporting events, but you may or may not really get there, and you may or may not get there in the way we get there, which I think is quite special. You know, I get up every morning, and I sit on the cushion, and I try to sit a couple hours every day. And, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years, and every time I do it, I swear to you, it just gets better and better. And some days, I sit down on the cushion, and it's like an atom bomb going off in my body. It's just so beautiful. It literally, it almost is like troubling. It's like, this is almost too much. But it's so beautiful. So there's all kinds of people in the world. And some of them climb mountains. Some of them ride their bicycle to sports games. Some of them sit on the cushion. But if this is your path, you don't have to live in a trailer. You know. But please stay on. If this is your path, please walk it with an open heart. Please stay on the path. Please be true to your true self. And I don't think you'll be disappointed. Case. The flower ornament scripture says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones. But because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. Verse. Sky covers, earth bears, making a mass or making a clump, pervading the universe without bound, breaking down subatomic particles with no insight. Getting to the end of the mysterious subtlety, who distinguishes turning towards from turning away? Buddhas and patriarchs come to pay the debt for what they said. Ask old teacher Wang of Nan Chuan. Each person just eats one stalk of vegetable. You say, how? This is your stalk of vegetable today, sitting on this cushion. How delicious. How delicious.